this man can do anything, so I'm going to put in a personal request. Kevin, congratulations to you and to Global Exchange and all those people who got the fair trade thing with Starbucks. Now let's take it one step further. Starbucks is destroying small family-owned cafes in this country. Let's put them out of business now. Let's make it real fair trade. We have all this energy and momentum. We are not going to stop halfway through. We're going to get the whole thing. Our next speaker is Teddy Edward Goldsmith, who is one of the pioneers of the ecological movement in the UK, and for the last 3 decades has been involved in campaigns against the nuclear industry, large dams, the World Bank, and the FAO. He has stood as a Green Party candidate at 3 elections and has taught at many universities, including Michigan University. As a staff member at Bard College, he helped set up an international honors program, Global Ecology Course. He is the founding editor of The Ecologist. We all know The Ecologist, which was trashed because of what Monsanto did, the same magazine, Ecologist. And is author of numerous works, including A Blueprint for Survival, that triggered the foundation of the British Green Party. He wrote The Great U-Turn, The Social and Environmental Effects of Large Dams with Nicholas Hilliard, and The Way, an Ecological Worldview. I'm going to finish this, and before I get, you know, English is not my native language. I get very scared that I'm going to lose my words. So let me just complete it. In 1991, he was awarded the Right Livelihood Award in Stockholm, which is also known as the Alternative Nobel Prize. And his newest work is The Case Against the Global Economy, that red book, done, co-authored with, co-edited with Jerry Mander. I have my own story about Teddy. I first met Teddy as a student in India. You know, we used to run around trying to find those people who could inspire the other, you know, students. And he was the one who was always so accessible, and we would do radio shows. And I met him many years later, and much to my surprise, he still recognized me. It felt good. So in terms of The Ecologist, Ecologist magazine did a whole issue on Monsanto called the Monsanto Files. Monsanto got word of it and actually threatened the printer, and printer basically got rid of all 10,000 copies. Now, they made the biggest mistake because they didn't know who were the people behind it, because Teddy and others made sure that other, you know, ecologists in other languages, including Spanish and other languages, which was not done by Teddy, but other groups who were so angry because a right to information was being taken away, they put it out there. So more power to us. Teddy.
Well, we've had some, I think we've had some wonderful speakers today. I'd certainly have difficulty to get together a group of people like that in England at this moment, I think. All I know is if I wanted to start a real political party to take on the existing ones, the man I'd choose would be Daddy, where's he got to? Kevin Daggett. I don't think anybody could compete with him. Well, a few comments about what previous speakers said. First of all, I think it's important that we realize that we cannot reform the world back. That is an impossibility. And Herman Daly knows this too, because I visited him when he tried to reform the World Bank with 2 or 3 other very talented dissidents. And last time I went to see him, his office was in the basement. And he said, you can see that I'm not exactly succeeding because I used to be on the 5th floor. At least they can't demote me any further because there are no wine cellars in this building. The point is, it can't be reformed. I even wrote a letter to Mr. Wolfenson when he became head and explained to him in great length why it can't be reformed. And to my astonishment, he answered me. And he agreed. He said, I sympathize considerably with what you're saying, but I'm going to change everything. And as we've heard today, he has not really changed. He's made cosmetic changes, as Susan George has said, but he has not changed it in substance, nor can he. I remember one of the reasons, one of the times that Herman Daly was demoted in the World Bank is when he opposed the building of the Sardar Sarovar Dam on the Narmada River. He's there in front of me. And he wanted to stop this, and there was absolute pandemonium when he suggested it, because the bank has got to lend a lot of money, and when they can't find a more or less viable country that's not bankrupt, that's willing to spend a few billion dollars on a dam, they rejoice and open the champagne bottles. And Herman is going to put a stop to this. He's really unsportsmanlike. And that, I think, earned his move from the operations department to the planning department. I don't know if I'm right, Herman. It just can't be done. Well, I first found out about the World Dam when I was holidaying in Sri Lanka, one of the most beautiful places in the world. And I suppose I'm a bit of a masochist. I suppose I wouldn't be doing what I'm doing for so long if I hadn't have a streak. But I didn't have a streak of masochism in me. And I ended up looking at their dams and also their traditional irrigation systems. I saw in particular the Victoria Dam, funded by the Overseas Development Agency, our equivalent of the USAID. And that led me to look into this in great detail. I spent 4 years at it with a colleague of mine, and we did this three-volume book on the social and environmental effects of large dams. The third one was a review of the literature. We actually went through 500 books and articles. I must have been mad in those days. 500 books and articles on the subject. And after I did this, I realized we did not find a single example of a big dam built in the tropics that was not only human, social, ecological, and economic disaster. I didn't find one. So needless to say, I mean, we all know that the problems, the ecological problems, the salinization of the land, the best land we have in the river valleys, the waterlogging of this land, you know, the total destruction of the forest all around, all the different ecological problems, the spread of waterborne diseases, which always occurs. But it's also a human disaster because it leads to the displacement of vast, vast numbers of people. In the Lokayan, a very good Indian, one of the best Indian journals on these issues, they say that since 1950, 21 million people have been displaced from their lands in India alone. And of those, about 16 million have been displaced by big dams. So if you just take India alone and look at the rest of the world, like China, where they've built even more dams than other countries, you could probably take a figure of 100 million people, which I think is a figure that Vandana Shiva takes, who have been displaced by development programs funded by the World Bank and others, whose overt goal is to fight poverty. Now, it can't be a very successful means of fighting poverty if it leads to the displacement of 100 million people from their land, maybe two-thirds by big dams. A lot of these funded by the World Bank. And the World Bank's main excuse for surviving, you know, for not closing down many of its departments, you know, which has been suggested by, I think, a congressional committee here, is that otherwise the poor would suffer so much. You need the World Bank to fight poverty. And it is one of the greatest creators of poverty of all time, by pushing millions and millions, tens of millions of people into the slums of the major cities. Now this, of course, it's an economic disaster because, for many reasons. First of all, people only will agree to order a dam if it's not too expensive. So they pretend it's always much cheaper than they really are. They end up by costing 2, 3, 4 times more. Worse still, these things tend to silt up very quickly because you get erosion, which they didn't cater for. So all the soil falls into the river and it blocks it all up. It silts up the dam, the reservoir, the dam becomes useless. Now, this has happened in one document I've seen on World Bank dams in India, 7 times faster than expected, which means that each one of those dams cost correspondingly more because it would have to be amortized over a correspondingly shorter period. So they're all economic disasters, too, and they end up by being paid for by the taxpayers. You know, that's where they're paid eventually. Anyhow, so much for dams. But then I looked at another issue, where I also saw, oh yes, before I move to this other issue, clearly then, people don't build dams for the reasons, the overt reasons that they proclaim. They've got a very different agenda. It's quite a, what is the agenda? Well, first of all, who profits from these dams? And the answer is the builders, the contractors, they make a mint. The governments, and governments of the different states, because they get huge kickbacks. I've been told in India that about 50% of the aid money, money lent by the bank and everything else, are stolen by the politicians and by the contractors, who are allowed to make much bigger profits, which they probably share with the politicians. I'm told that in Brazil it's 80%. Don't know if anybody has figures on these things. That's a figure I've been given by somebody quite high up there in Brazil. Well, so they got a different agenda. It's a different, everybody profits from building these dams. The dam makers, we, the Western governments here, because we sell all the turbines, our companies quite often build these things. Everybody profits from these things except for all the people, except for poor people who are displaced and for the natural world, which is completely ruined. So here we are. When I started looking at feeding the world, about the same time, we're talking about 20 years ago, started looking at all that. Here again, I can see that the World Bank, which to begin with, its main function was to fund infrastructural projects like big dams and harbors and airports so that the third world could trade with us. That was the object of the whole thing. Then they moved into pushing the green revolution. Well, green revolution really means high input agriculture. Now, it's perfectly clear to me, I won't go into this in great detail, I'm sure the Vandana Shiva is going to talk to you about this, that, and the gene revolution that followed in some detail. But basically, it meant pushing high-input agriculture. And on theoretical grounds alone, it is absolutely impossible for high-input agriculture to feed the world. How can it? Because the small farmers can't afford the inputs. So they're pushed into the slums. Because in order to earn the foreign exchange, to pay interest on the loans contracted, to build the factories, to build the dams, to provide the irrigation water, etc., to buy all the inputs, they've got to export all the food, which they do in any case. So there's no longer any good land left in the third world to produce food for local people. The main cause of malnutrition in the third world is the export business. It is a fact that land, all the good land, is used for export crops, so there's no longer any land left to feed people. I flew over KwaZulu-Natal. It is to me, and what you all know, that in the WTO, among the WTO regulations, countries have got to, they're forced to export food so long as there's a market for it. Even today, even according to the latest regulations passed by the Uruguay rounds, if I remember rightly, even if people in their own country are starving. That wasn't in the original rules, if I remember. For me, I mean, the idea of exporting food in a huge way from a country like India, where we're between 40 and 60% children are known to be malnourished, is absolutely criminal. Now, this is what the World Bank is pushing. That's what it pushes, WTO as well, but they're all brothers and sisters. They work together, the same thing. They're pushing this as well. Now, not only then are the peasants pushed into the slums, and the food is exported, so there's no food left for local people, but the land is then turned into dust by this chemical agriculture. Much of the land in the third world, not everywhere, but much of the land is much more vulnerable to erosion than it is in temperate areas, because its organic content is much lower, and because the rains, when they come, they all come at once and they wash away and stop so. So in fact, what they are trying to do by forcing high input agriculture on the third world, otherwise called modern agriculture, is to push the peasants into the slums, export the food, and turn the agricultural land into dust. Now, no one can tell me that this is a sensible way of feeding people. No one can tell me that by doing this, they're even trying to feed people. Trying to feed people is not part of the deal. The FAO in Rome is not involved in feeding people. We did a special issue of The Ecologist in which we accused the FAO of being the main agent of malnutrition and famine in the world. And we raided their offices and their meetings for some time. You see, perfectly clear, this is not, they've got a totally different agenda. And there again, it's the same thing. Who are the beneficiaries of this high-input agriculture? Quite obviously, our governments and our corporations. If we in England push this, it's because we want Balfour Beatty, our main building company, or Bechtel, to put up, build the dams and sell the turbines. We want to get sales for Fison's fertilizers. We want Shell Chemicals to sell the pesticides. We want AstraZeneca to sell the hybrid seeds or genetic engineered seeds. In other words, we want our corporations to sell the inputs. That's why we push that. Now, Mr. Blair is just as bad as your Mr. Clinton, and always predecessors Mrs. Thatcher, who is outdone, in fact. Give a damn whether Africans or Indians starve to death. What they want to do is sell inputs to the third world. So you see, if you look, the more you look at these problems, the more cynical you can get. I was fairly innocent and gullible when I was young. I become more cynical every year, but it's perfectly clear to me that nothing we are doing is really trying to solve problems. In fact, I don't think there's anyone who's paid in any of our institutions, state institutions or international institutions, to solve problems. Their agenda is a quite different one. And this is true for me of the setting up of these institutions, the World Bank, the IMF, the WTO, etc. The WTO followed, of course. It was the GATT. They wanted to have the ITO, but it didn't get through. In any case, it was set up after the war. And now we must ask, this is why, we want to work out what is their agenda. Why were these things set up in the first place? For me, all three of these institutions were set up as tools, and very specialized, and very specific tools, for the implementation of a special policy. And what was this policy? The answer is Bretton Woods. The answer is simply to bring the whole third world into the orbit of the Western industrial system so that our corporations could continue expanding, so that they'd have a continually expanding market for their products, continually expanding source of cheap raw materials and cheap labor. I don't have to tell you that this is exactly the same goal of British colonialism in the 19th century. Let me tell you, let me quote one of the main architects of the British imperial system, Cecil Rhodes, after whom Rhodesia is named. He said to the Parliament, "We must find new lands from which we can easily obtain raw materials and at the same time exploit the cheap slave labor that is available from the natives of the colonies. The colonies also provide a dumping ground for the surplus goods produced in our factories." It says it all. There is absolutely no difference between that program and the program set up at Bretton Woods to bring the third world into the orbit of the Western system. The difference is that the first was called colonialism, the second is called development. They're the same. They're the same. Free trade was a chosen device for achieving this goal at Bretton Woods. Sounds good, free trade. You know, the level playing field establishes a level playing field. But what we haven't been told, and people don't seem to realize, is that the level playing field is a great place for the powerful to operate on, not for the weak. If I wanted to confront Mr. Mike Tyson, I wouldn't want to do so on a level playing field. If Britain imposed free trade on the world in 1860 to 1873, it's because Britain was the most powerful country in the world. We had the greatest economy, the world's only big financial center, and we had a navy. And if anyone didn't do what we said, we sent out the navy to fix that trouble. And it's no coincidence that it's America that is the most powerful country in the world in 1944. That's why they imposed free trade. And it's because of this free trade. What is free trade? Well, it's not even free trade what we have today. Free trade is really the removal of tariffs. We've gone way beyond that. With our non-tariff barriers and all the other things, we are now creating conditions in which we are removing systematically every single law, regardless of why it was set up. if it happens to upset the interests of the corporations, if it reduces their profits. It doesn't matter if this law is essential for protecting the poor, the unemployed, the old, the sick, local communities, local economies, the natural world, to prevent global warming. Who gives a damn? If it reduces the interests of the corporations, it is disallowed. It's got to go. There's even a law that says that. There's a thing. It's not in the World Trade Organization, to my knowledge. It's in the NAFTA treaty. And they would have brought it in the MAI, which has unfortunately failed. They tried to get it in again in Seattle. It would have been imposed again. It's a law that says, I think, is it called the non-violation clause? I can't remember. But nevertheless, this is what it says. If a government passes a measure that reduces the profits of a corporation, even if this measure does not violate any of the WTO regulations, now this is the most amazing, even if it doesn't, it still is illegal, and the company that suffers can seek compensation on the basis of the profits which on their own reckoning they would have made if the thing had not been disallowed. And this has been used several times. Already the Ethyl Corporation thing against Canada sued the Canadian government for $250 million. It didn't get it, but it got something, because the government of Canada wouldn't allow them to sell in Canada MMT, some poisonous additive for gas. And they got it. There we are. I've got to come to an end. What I'm going to say, in any case, that what we're looking there is not just deregulation, it is also re-regulation. We're not just removing laws that interfere with the interests of these corporations. We are replacing them with laws that protect their interests. You see, laws that are designed to protect small communities and everything else are being replaced by laws designed to protect the interests of the corporations. So you'll get what we're getting is a new form of protectionism. But they are protecting the interests of the corporations instead of the interests of local people, local communities, and the national environment. Well, I won't go much further. I think I've said my bit. My conclusion is that we can't go further in this direction. If we go much further, we will make what is not possible. We can't. You see, I just take one of the things I talked about, which is the displacement of peoples today. If we go ahead with commodifying, with privatizing, or rather opening the rural areas of the third world to the corporations, which is what we've planned to do. Now, it wasn't allowed in India. There's a law against corporations buying land. That law has been rescinded. And now already McDonald's has bought a lot of land in India, and there are other corporations buying it. If they go along doing this, if suddenly we decide to commercialize the subsistence agriculture in India, well, we're going to have about 700 million people to push off the land. That is to say, about 500 million small farmers who farmed through 3 or 4 acres, and all of the small shopkeepers, street vendors, artisans who depend on the farming community, they are condemned. You know yourself that you cannot survive with a farm of 2 or 3 acres. And when you start development and industrialization, they will go to the slums. You will have slums of 50, 60 million people. Not just in India, but in China and elsewhere. We are seeing a process there which is impossible. And what we're trying to do is impossible on many, many counts, including the fact that we are now heading in the direction of global warming, by far and away the most serious problem we've ever faced. If we don't take action today, this planet will be uninhabitable, probably this century. So it is absolutely urgent that we put an end to what is happening today, and we shift our society in a totally different direction. For me, to return to something, to a local economy run by small companies catering for local and regional markets, small companies that are controllable by governments, which these corporations are not, and which themselves have an interest in their own citizens, interest in assuring the continuance of their own communities, as to a certain extent they have did in the past. I don't think there's any alternative but to this. It is the object of that book, which Jerry Mander and I co-edited, which has done rather well. We sold about 40,000 or 50,000 of them in the United States. It's now coming out in a few other countries. I don't think that there's any alternative. The only thing is we don't have much time to waste. We've really got to work hard at it. Many thanks.